This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The problem for me is that it exists because we don't want to solve it, we as a country.
We spend the hour with attorney Andrew Rankin discussing the state of U.S. immigration.
The weaponization of the law, it's incredibly two-faced. You want them out, you don't like what they're doing, but you want their labor and you want it cheap, and you can't have it both ways.
Attorney Rankin delves into legal, political, and economic issues surrounding U.S. immigration and the Trump administration's stepped-up attacks on migrants.
And I'm going to be watching the federal precedent very closely, and if I see losses piling up, I think there's a very good chance that the Supreme Court stays out of it.
Andrew Rankin discusses birthright citizenship and possibilities for fighting back against Trump's increasingly aggressive assault on migrants and their rights. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Veteran immigration attorney Andrew Rankin of Memphis, Tennessee, spoke to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke in early March about political, legal, and social issues surrounding immigration to the United States.
Please describe some of the technical and legal complications that frequently come up with cases of solo as well as family immigration, things that maybe American citizens who aren't familiar with immigration at all would be surprised to hear about.
Our laws are, I would say, that is an incredibly easy question for me to answer because I have this discussion with American citizens all the time. Our laws are like an interstate that was built for a much smaller city, and then the engineers realized they should have made the lanes wider. Our laws are built from 1952, which is our modern, Thomas, I'm using scare quotes now.
Sure.
Immigration Act. And very few substantive updates have been made to that act since that time. And it's like city engineers and planners making an interstate for a city that now has 19 million people and there's constant gridlock. And what I think average citizens don't understand when they say, well, why can't they just come the legal way? Or why can't they just get their papers? Why is it so hard? It's because our laws were built for an America that no longer exists.
How many, by your estimation or knowledge, immigrants come to this country on an annual basis? And what are some of the causes of upward or downward shifts in that movement of people? I'm thinking, for example, of obviously Civil War in Central America in the 70s that drove Salvadoran migration to this country, but there have been others. What are the raw numbers we're talking about?
I would say annually 2 to 3 million. You mentioned we're gonna encapsulate as far as the upward or downward shifts. I think what we can encapsulate, what you said, Thomas, we're going to call that civil strife of one variation or another. It could be the El Salvadoran Civil War. It could be the Mariel boat lift of the Cubans in the late 70s and early 80s. It could be the Rwandan genocide in the mid 1990s. We can go on and on and on. It's a sad thing to say, but there are a lot of sad, sad experiences. But we can also say weather conditions. All right. We can say hurricanes, drought, famine. We can also say economic insufficiency. There's nothing wrong with my country, but I just can't make a buck. There's a lot of that. And then simple desires to reunite with family. I've got family elsewhere and I want to be near them. I want to be with them. And then I would also say the ebb and flow of fear-based claims as conditions change on the ground in a given country. And we're seeing a lot of that in Nicaragua. I think we can also add Venezuela to a civil strife and fear-based claim. But I would say those five bases are going to tick up or tick down the overall number of migrants. The great majority of migrants can be put into one of those subcategories.
Okay. One should add that, of course, under civil strife, as you characterized situations in Central America and Venezuela, the United States does play a role. U.S. foreign policy has more than has had an inordinate effect since at least the Kennedy administration's Alliance for Progress in this sort of move to Latin America.
Just a quick detour, but I think relevant to your point, Thomas. Before Fidel Castro took over Cuba, when Fulgencio Batista was in charge, we know that the U.S. and Fulgencio were bed buddies as far as their cooperation. And then that all went by the wayside when the Cuban Revolution happened. So there's plenty of precedent for the U.S. playing a foreign policy role in the creation of current day problems.
How big a problem, quote unquote, is the illegal immigration in the U.S. and how does it mainly happen? I.e., overstaying a legal visa, crossing at a non-checkpoint, or what? And if you could include or discuss the notions of asylum, phrase called withholding of removal, and understand that both problem and illegal immigration are debatable and highly political. What are your thoughts on this area, sir?
Yeah, Thomas, and I think that's. I think I like your phrasing of the question as an initial matter, because whether it is a problem, yes, it just depends on who you ask. The problem for me is that it exists because we don't want to solve it, we as a country. So they call it a problem. But this issue comes, it's connected to what I said initially. Our laws are old. And every single effort to modernize these laws has failed for political infighting. And so that's where these problems of illegal immigration come out. What would you do if I go up to a common person on the street, the most conservative person I can find, and I say, I'm going to paint you a picture of a realistic situation, and you tell me what you would do? I don't see too many people willing to die on the hill and say, no, I'd stay in my country and suffer. No, you would look for greener pastures. So do you want to call it illegal? We could say illegal in that it transgresses federal law, and we're going to get to that, Thomas. But illegal in the sense of what? Beyond that it's a violation of technical violation of law, these are people looking to better their lots in life. That's what it is. But because it's a transgression of federal law, we put this illegal term on it and we call these people aliens. We devalue them. We take away their respect and their wholeness of person because of their desire to make better lives for themselves, while average Americans who don't know what they're talking about sit in judgment of these people like they're kings and queens, when if they were in the same situation, they'd probably be doing the same thing. So that is my not just professional take, but I see this on the ground in my own office, not just as an attorney talking to Thomas for a Zoom radio publication. I see this with real people. I get to know these people. I laugh with them. I cry with them. And 99% of them, that's all they want. But we call it a problem because the minute you call it a lawbreaker, it's a problem. You're illegal. It's unchecked migration. So that is what's really happening. And then as far as how it happens, it's both, Thomas. If you overstay a legal visa, you are an overstay, right? And you become removable under Section 237 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, specifically 237A1B of the Act. But also, if you cross the border at a place not designated by the Attorney General or the Secretary of Homeland Security, you also cross into the country without permission. So it happens both ways. And you are still removable, just under a different section of law. People who come across without inspection are subject to removal under Section 212A6AI of the Immigration and Nationality Act. And this notion of asylum and withholding, this is important. I think it's important for all the viewers who are interested in this area. Asylum We're going to say it this way. Asylum is permanent protection. Withholding of removal is less than that. And we'll get into it. So if you apply for asylum, first of all, you have to do that within 1 year of arrival. 1 year. Otherwise, the application is late. And if you don't get an exception to that rule, you're limited to withholding of removal as far as your protection. Now,
can someone who's crossed over without, you know, approval apply for asylum, say, 6 months later, and sort of all's forgiven and the asylum application is considered valid?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's according to anybody that's not the government, because the government's going to say, no, you can't, because they're putting in all these blocks. But there is a federal statute in Section 208A of the Immigration Act nobody seems to talk about or care about, because why would you? Why would we not look at laws? We can just be hateful. It says any, and I'll even use the term alien like it's described in the act. We're going to call them non-citizens to be respectful, but it says any. It doesn't say most, or those who cross legally, or those who don't anger the president. It says any. So it doesn't matter if you come legally, illegally, half legally, handicapped, parole. We can come up with any variation we want. They have a right to do it. Now, the government is the hook. Now, if you drink the Kool-Aid, Thomas, you have to drink the Kool-Aid to be on board with it. But what they're doing is they're saying there's a statute that says the government can put in conditions on how the asylum process works. And they're stretching that law until it squeaks. And they're seeing how far they can stretch it before the rope snaps. And that's where all these regulations that are curtailing asylum are coming from. People think this is coming from presidential fiats, and it might be, but they're grounding it in this in a statute in Section 208, in a different section of 208 that says the government can, in its discretion, put in additional requirements on the asylum process. But to the point where you shut it off, no, sir. And that's what they're doing. So to go back to the fundamental differences that I think are very important, asylum can lead to a green card. Withholding of removal cannot, ever. Yeah. Like, ever. It all you get with withholding of removal, you get two things. You get a work permit, and you cannot be deported to the country from which your removal is withheld. Now, this is important, Thomas. Let me give you a hypothetical for you and your listeners. John Q. Client gets withholding of removal from Mexico. ICE lawfully deports him to Honduras.
Why would Honduras take him?
What they do is they try to find a third country, whether through diplomatic, you wash my back, I wash yours. But ICE can lawfully seek a third country to which a withholding of removal grantee can be sent. And even worse than that, Thomas, they can conscript the non-citizen himself to work with ICE to facilitate his own removal to a third country. Think about, to the viewers, let that sink around in your head. You've been told the government can't send you back to Mexico, but yet you're hailed into the ICE office and said, you're going to work with us. You're going to make applications for travel documents to different countries. And if you don't do it, we can perhaps even charge you criminally with obstructing removal, your own removal from the country. So Honduras, Guatemala, Belize, Costa Rica, it's nice in Costa Rica, they say. And if we can send you there, and if they're willing to issue the travel documents, nothing says we can't send you back to a third country. So withholding of removal gives you some stuff, but it doesn't give you much. Whereas asylum is permanent protection. They can't send you back to a third country. And after 1 year of asylum status, you can acquire PR status, permanent residency, and then onwards to naturalization.
So you're not protected from duress by officials. It's obviously never been really tested to the extreme, so I sounds horrible.
That was Los Tigres del Norte with guest Zach De La Rocha singing Somos Más Americanos. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Now here's more from attorney Andrew Rankin in conversation with Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke about the perils that migrants face upon arriving in the United States. He also discusses laws and strategies that make it possible for them to stay.
Let's move on a little bit. Explain why you, as an immigration lawyer, would advise new arrivals to hire an immigration lawyer, and what's your estimation or knowledge of the immigration success rate of those that do so versus those who file without a lawyer? And how is an immigrant aided by family members that are already living in the U.S.?
These are great questions, Thomas. Let's start with your first one. When people first come to the U.S., they are so unfamiliar with our legal system, and they become prey to unscrupulous individuals. I have these appointments twice to three times a week with people who have been scammed, victimized, cheated, or swindled by unsavory characters preying on new arrivals, promising them the sun, moon, and the stars, only for them to wake up and realize that it was nothing but dust. And the money's gone, the phone number doesn't work, or they don't answer the phone, or the business has been shut down. We can go on. So it is imperative. The minute you get here and you want to know your rights, if you don't start with a solid foundation from an actual attorney, this is not a plug for Mr. Rankin, this is a plug for my profession, seek it from an attorney, then you are putting yourself in that position to be taken advantage of. And most of the people don't know they're being taken advantage of until they've already been taken advantage of. And it's horrible. Think about where this money comes from, Thomas. I don't even want to know where they get the money to pay me, much less where they get it to pay the fraudster. How many people do they indebt themselves to? How many people do they indebt themselves to get here, Thomas? Then you're indebting yourself more to pay legal fees. And this is what people experience when they don't know to whom to turn. So this is one of the first things you should do. Take a consult. take several consults. Go to Google, read people's reviews, talk to your friends and family. If they give you a name, ask, is that person a lawyer? Or is that just somebody who runs a whatever service in a Hispanic, a foreign language speaking neighborhood? Do your research on it. And then you can avoid being victimized. As far as success rates, the last statistic I saw, and I wrote it down because I had it in my notes from a prior discussion, I found this amazing. In detention, the percentage of respondents who won their cases with a lawyer was about 18%. Without a lawyer, 3%.
Okay.
Now go to non-detention. These numbers are going to blow your mind. 74% to 13%. So 74% of non-detained respondents who had a lawyer got some form of relief from their case, whatever the relief is. And only 13% who chose to proceed pro se, either by choice or by lack of financial options, got some relief. So you see a stark difference out of detention, but even in detention, 18 versus 3. That's pretty crazy. So if you have the financial means, it's one of the first things you should be saving up for, especially if you know you have immigration issues. Yes, you have to save up for rent and your normal bills, but you should be thinking about how am I going to afford an attorney, knowing that there is so much higher probability of some kind of success with a lawyer than without.
All right, good. Thank you for that answer. Candidate and now President Trump and his new, I thought he was ICE director. He's actually the White House Executive Associate Director of Enforcement and Removal Operations, Tom Homan. And Trump's entire administration repeatedly stress in what I'll characterize as chauvinistic, hyperbolic, fear-mongering language, using as a stereotype, the quote-unquote criminal migrant, criminal alien, in which they give evidence by using a few isolated and often violent, sensationalized criminal cases involving migrants. Some are quite terrible crimes. But they always will, if available, never neglect to mention gang affiliations. That's part of their campaign. So as to tar migrants together verbally, stereotypically, with these same tars and smears. This gives this administration political cover to wage this campaign of roundups, workplace raids, and even potentially raids at schools and churches. These government officials nonetheless insist they're enforcing the immigration law as it is today. How true is that? What do they mean when they claim that being here illegally is a crime? And is it an ongoing crime? If so, a felony, a misdemeanor? Is it a traffic ticket, that level of crime? In other words, what's the illegality of illegal immigration?
Yeah. So I did an exercise that didn't get a satisfactory answer, but let's assume you're Canadian and you're looking down at the United States, and let's pick somebody who
south,
we can all looking south. What did I say?
Down on the map, but that's south.
We're looking down on the map. Yes, we're looking south. Okay. I picked someone that we can all agree is a bad American. I picked Timothy McVeigh. I could have picked others, but I picked Timothy McVeigh. And then I said what Timothy McVeigh did. Everyone would agree that's bad. And then as a Canadian, I would say everyone in America is like Timothy McVeigh. And would that anger Americans to be generalized by the few dozen over the last 30, 40 years who have caused terrible suffering to citizens of this country? No reasonable person would say, oh yeah, I'm okay with being associated with that person. But we seem to be okay with doing it to immigrants by taking Lake and Riley's murderer and the man who set the woman on fire in the New York subway, and the random shooting in San Francisco on the Bay, and we're going to say all these people are rapists, pillaging, murdering, stealing, eating the dogs and the cats. It's okay for us to do it to them, but if Canadians did it to us, it's a national outrage. No one's been able to satisfactorily answer why it's good for the goose, but not good for the gander. So keep in mind, this is what the government's doing. As you said, it is making Americans who are usually uneducated about this stuff, giving them something to believe and calling it a day, stop sowing that fear. So when they go out into the community and they see a brown person, it's open season.
And that's
So
the only story that could possibly hold for this person they are now looking at, right?
exactly right. Because
Yeah.
if they don't do their own research and get to know some of these people and find a little compassion and civility, all they're going to see is what is on Fox or Newsmax or wherever, and that's what they'll take into their own lives. And that's how the seeds are planted, instead of recognizing that there are bad apples in every bunch. There are bad doctors, there are bad journalists, there are bad lawyers, there are bad chefs, dentists, engineers, and street sweepers. But if you think about the whole of that group by the sum of its worst members, you will never have an accurate picture of reality. Although you'll have some really good news media and press gaggles because you have a lot of vitriol to spew about the members of that group you don't like. And the Homeland Security Department has invested a millions of dollars in this fear campaign. Self-deport, go home, stay out, that Noam and her bosom buddy Tom Homan have put together without recognizing that you're highlighting the worst members of the group and then making everybody else guilty by association. Now, to get to the law part of it, because that's the last thing the government wants to talk about. They want to say it's they're enforcing laws, they're doing this, they're doing that, but they're enforcing very little of the actual law and just selling it to the American people because they've already sowed that fear. So once you sow the fear, you don't need much to sell the rest. So I'll give them credit. The art of the deal, President Trump does it well because he knows once you sow an opinion in here and they don't get to see anything else, to get them in hook, line, and sinker, all you need are a couple of sound bites and you got them. So let's talk about the actual law on this, Thomas. Section 275 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, subsection A1, does make it a misdemeanor to cross the border at a time or place not designated by the government. And then subsequent transgressions of that same statute make it felonious. The misdemeanor punishment is 6 months, felonious punishment is 2 years and or a fine. But that is it.
Does that mean
That is the
crossing
statute.
multiple times or crossing and staying a longer period? Once you've crossed and stayed, that's only
Both.
one incident, right?
Yeah, it's one incident per entry. So if you come back a second, third time, then it becomes subsequent and the gravity is upgraded from misdemeanor to felony. And that's section 275 of the Act, of the Immigration Act, but in the criminal code, it's found at 8 USC 1325.
I'm just wondering who keeps track of these multiple entries if they're I'm just wondering that.
Yeah, so this would be the Justice Department. So you don't see these prosecutions in the interior because imagine the U.S. attorney for my area, for the Western District of Tennessee, telling his AUSAs, "Hey, y'all, put down that child sex trafficking ring you're trying to break up because we got Jose here and he's crossed twice. He didn't have a traffic ticket, but we found out where Jose is. He's a double crosser. You need to drop what you're doing and prosecute that guy." So that's why in the interior, it doesn't really happen. But in the border, they've got divisions of the U.S. attorney's offices that handle these types of issues. And so you see them more at the border, not all the time, but you're going to see them more at the border when they're encountered crossing. They'll be referred to the Marshals Service for federal prosecution. And then when federal prosecution is over, they're turned back over to DHS for either release into court proceedings or possibly even expedited removal, which we can get into later on in the
Okay,
conference.
if time permits. Immigration law is often compared to, or basically stated, it's primarily concerned with a consistently available yet relatively cheap labor supply to supplement and put downward pressure on worker demands, domestic worker demands for higher wages and better conditions. Is this still true? And would you care to comment on the uses and misuses of immigration law enforcement to undercut worker struggles here in the US?
Yeah, people want immigrants when it suits their own interests. And I've seen that. And if that offends anybody, it's the truth. And the truth sometimes is ugly. The same people who go out and criticize the state of immigration in our country are those who want cheap labor, cheap prices, and are the ones that are saying immigrants are stealing American jobs. I'm still looking for that one person who can find me 50 people that are looking like me and you who are ready to pick lettuce or strawberries or build my house. I've still yet to find that crew. So it's what the misuse, the weaponization of the law, it's incredibly two-faced. You want them out, you don't like what they're doing, but you want their labor and you want it cheap. And you can't have it both ways. So I think in that sense, it is a horrible misuse for to take from them what they can give to serve your own selfish interests, and then when they're done serving those selfish interests, you take your foot and you kick them in the behind like they never mattered to your life at all. I feel very strongly about that because I see that in my own city, and it breaks my heart every time.
I got one job, two jobs, three when I need them. I got five roommates in this one studio, but I never really see them. And we all came America trying to get a lap dance from Lady Freedom. But now Lady Liberty is acting like Hillary Banks with a prenup. Man, I was brave, sailing on graves. Don't think I didn't notice those tombstones disguised as waves. I'm no dummy. Here's something funny. You could be an immigrant without risking your lives or crossing these borders with thrifty supplies. All you gotta do is see the world with new eyes.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Far I come,
we get the job done.
Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Look how far I come.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
It's a hard line when you're an import, baby boy. It's hard times when you ain't sent for braces.
From the Hamilton mixtape, that was Immigrants, We Get the Job Done. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Next, attorney Andrew Rankin assesses the likelihood that birthright citizenship, codified in the 14th Amendment, might be overturned by the Supreme Court.
Another avenue of attack that the Trump administration has recently launched, I'm sure they didn't come up with this argument, against immigrants, are challenges to birthright citizenship. Could you summarize the issues and case precedent surrounding this aspect of the 14th Amendment that was clearly intended at its writing and passage to make citizens of all the formerly enslaved peoples of the United States? It was then interpreted in the 1898 SCOTUS decision called Wong Kim Ark that someone born in the U.S. to parents who are not diplomats or representatives of foreign governments were automatically U.S. citizens. This refers to the concept of jus soli, or I guess was being subject to the jurisdiction or law of that particular soil, or I guess land of birth. My understanding is that is the basis for birthright citizenship claims for immigrant children. Do you believe there's any chance this could be overturned?
So this is going to be the answer that is all legal. And I think it's important for a bit of context. No lower court since Wong Kim Ark has given the current administration any inroad to believe that a child born in this country of just two parents who do not have immigration status is not a citizen. So, this is important to understand how the Supreme Court works. Okay, the Supreme Court takes most of its cases by something called certiorari. And certiorari is given in certain circumstances. The most common is when there's a split of federal authority, a circuit split. You got four courts that come out on an issue one way, four courts that come the other way. SCOTUS has to come in and resolve it. Another is a state court of highest authority, like the Tennessee Supreme Court, ruling on an issue of constitutional scope. And you could have other federal questions that are of national importance. This is important to know because the Supreme Court is going to use one of these rationales to determine whether to hear a case. So I opened with my initial comment to say this. I think there's a fair prospect that the Supreme Court isn't going to touch this with a 10-foot pole. Because in order for them to do it, I think Roberts, the moderate now, moderate voice of the court, still a Republican appointee when Chief Justice Rehnquist died and Bush 43 nominated and the Senate confirmed him, but he has become the more moderate justice. And this is important because in order to grant certiorari, you have to have four justices. Many people think it's a majority. It is not. You need four justices to grant certiorari on a case. You need five for a majority opinion.
Which, of course, is the court
So
accepting the case, right?
that's correct. Certiorari is them accepting the case. But I think there's going to be, because this is highly politicized, I think there's going to be several justices who are going to say, we need to stay out of this because there's no reason to get in it, Thomas. There is no split of authority. There is no national importance. We already said in Wong Kim Ark what the 14th Amendment covers as it relates to this issue. Why are we talking about it again? Chief Justice Roberts may say to the others. We need to stay out of it. And we've seen, Thomas, with the several lawsuits filed against the president's executive order, how many of them have been successful for the president? Goose egg. Goose egg. And so, as these cases wind their ways from the district court up to the circuit court of appeals, the more losses that rack up, the more that's going to weigh, I believe, on someone like Chief Justice Roberts as he tries to tell the court as they determine whether to take up the case. We need to exercise judicial restraint. And this is important because these justices discuss cases in private conferences. Not even the clerks are in the room, as Hamilton says, the room where it happened. So it's these are the nine justices. They're the only ones that are in the room. And so Roberts is naturally an incrementalist. Even before he became the de facto swing vote, he has always been an incrementalist. He is famous for saying, if it is not necessary to say more, the court should not say more. And so I think the Trump administration's job in this executive order has always been to get to the Supreme Court. I don't think they're that aloof that they really thought a lower court would say, it's fine. Your executive order is upheld. I think they knew they're going to go into litigation, they're going to lose, and they're going to get a chance to make their case to the Supreme Court. But I'm of the opinion that there's plenty of basis for them to stay out of it, which of course would then avoid the political fight and it would leave the precedent untouched. And to get into that precedent, it's important to understand what the authority shows. If you are a diplomat from whatever country and you give birth to a baby, you're not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Why? Because you have what? Diplomatic immunity. So you're not subject to the laws of this country. So it would make sense that those babies are not American citizens by birth, and they have to go through the normal immigration processes as anybody else would. But if you are not a foreign diplomat, you are just Thomas and Andrew, who are fathers of children, and we don't have any papers, and we're married to our wives who also have no papers, those babies are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States because their parents are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. So they are citizens by birth. And so it transmuted, of course, the 14th Amendment came out of Reconstruction. We know that. And it was, of course, at the end of the Civil War, and the problems that they were solving through the 14th Amendment were very different. But 30 years later, in Wong Kim Ark, the Supreme Court made clear that it's not just talking about formerly enslaved people. It's talking about anybody who's born here, whose parents are also subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. So I'm going to be watching the federal precedent very closely, and if I see losses piling up, I think there's a very good chance that the Supreme Court stays out of it.
Okay, good. At the same time, I was struck and frankly horrified to hear this Mr. Homan say, when asked about a birthright citizenship, that he had no trouble nevertheless deporting their parents who don't have documentation with the expectation that the baby would still have a right to stay in the U.S., but of course would be orphaned. It was just horrible to hear them think about it, but he, I guess, wanted to respond to the idea that that loophole would remain. Comment on that, but also, what are sanctuary cities and what legal exemptions do they actually have, or is being a so-called sanctuary city simply a political statement?
Yeah, double down on the first one, Thomas. You have to say that. The minute that any administration official backs off, you're gonna get the ire of the president. But immigration is without question one of the top three issues on which the president campaigned, for sure. So any statement contrary to the America First policy is going to be met with outrage by the administration. So no matter how cruel it is, deport the baby, deport the parents, leave the babies on the street, doesn't matter. They're U.S. citizens. They can stay, they can go, they can come back, whatever. Let the auntie raise them. Let the cousin who's been in jail three times raise them. They have to say that because otherwise it would send mixed messages to the administration. Well, wait a minute. Now you're willing to draw lines here. If the babies are citizens, you grab the parents, and whatever happens to the babies, they can take them with them. The parents make the decisions on how to parent their children. It's not for the federal government to say what you should do with your two-month-old that's breastfeeding. So it's a common double-down tactic to remove any all doubt from the citizenry how little the government actually cares.
Yeah.
And I see that all the time locally. Now, as far as sanctuary cities,
it seems,
I think,
to
you
be
put
assuming
it well,
that when the child comes of age, they can reclaim their citizenship or something, but it's just a pipe dream.
It is, and there's a federal statute, 22 USC 2705, that talks about passports, that says if you have a passport that's issued for the maximum period allowed by law, minors is 5 years, adults is 10 years, then that's conclusive proof of citizenship. So as long as they have a birth certificate, if they travel abroad, a passport, yes. As far as that comment goes, Thomas, they can always come back to the U.S., but
yeah.
Living in, Nicaragua, when they have a right to be in the U.S. is certainly not the best dilemma to be facing. As far as sanctuary cities, I think you said it well. Political ideals is what this is about. There's no legal definition. You are now entering a sanctuary city. We welcome your presence. No, it is an idea. And to put it succinctly, it's this. A sanctuary city is a city or an area that has decided, for its own political reasons and values, to limit cooperation with federal immigration officials. Period. That is the idea of it. Now, what does it look like on the ground? Because that might be too abstract to conceptualize. So let's put some meat on the bone. What would it look like? Well, let's say, Thomas has overstayed his Canadian he's a Canadian and he's overstayed his visitor's visa, and he commits an act of domestic battery, let's call it that. And Thomas is in jail. And the ICE officer wants to lodge a detainer on Thomas so that they can monitor the progress of his criminal case for potential enforcement later. And the sanctuary jurisdiction says, no, no, because I said no, we won't honor your detainer. You can bring it to our jail. You can put it in the president's fingerprint on it. When you leave, we're going to take it and we're going to put it in the shredder. And whatever happens to Thomas with his criminal proceedings is none of your business. Now, if you want to go out into the community and deal with Thomas individually, that's your business. But we're not going to abet your efforts. So that would be how it takes shape. It can also take shape of letting ICE officers come into the jail. Instead of just lodging detainers, they could say, we want to come in and look at your prison rosters. They could say, when we're all dead, you can do that. But the serious point is you're not voluntarily cooperating with federal partners in that exercise. So if Thomas is on that list, he could be with Andrew right below, right above, and that list would stay in the possession of the custodian of the jail and not turned over for fact-checking through databases to see if Thomas is legal in the country.
So you don't believe that despite the threats of the Trump administration to sort of enforce immigration law against those that don't enforce it, in other words, those that are sort of maintaining this civil disobedience stance towards federal immigration issues, you don't think they'll be successful in that? And I say that because, and I kind of want to tie this off and sort of finish the conversation, but I want to bring up the fact that Obama's 8 years as president ostensibly saw some of the highest rates of deportation we've seen in many years. And comparing that to the Trump's first term, where you had things like this civil disobedience within sanctuary city jurisdictions, so that his numbers were not nearly as high. Sort of square those two facts and then go back to what you said at the very beginning, how this is a willful attempt to not solve immigration. But the United States, maybe it's the ruling class that wants to keep, you know, workers in permanent limbo and permanent fear, that they don't really want to solve legal pathways to citizenship that would amnesty people already here, you know, forget these, you know, return to your country of origin and pay these huge fines. These people, should, if they've been here long enough, they should be amnestied and, you know, at least made permanent residents.
Yeah. So what we're seeing is, and we see this in the media, is that sanctuary jurisdictions are saying, at least for now, you want some, come get some. We're not going to be bullied around and pushed. Now, do I think that's going to hold long term? No, Thomas. I think when the government takes an action, others are going to watch, whether it's withholding funding, whether it is trying to bring some sort of criminal or investigatory mechanism to bear on those officials. I don't think other jurisdictions are going to sit back and say, let them come. I'll put the handcuffs on myself. I think it's going to be a wait and see approach. For right now, a lot of jurisdictions are calling their bluff. You want to do something, we can sue you. We'll take it to court. But once there's a fallout, if there's a fallout, I think there is going to be a sentiment within other jurisdictions that say, well, we don't want what happened to them to happen to us, because we've seen what they can do. And it obviously won in some kind of court if there was a lawsuit. So I think wait and see for now, possible backpedaling if the government is able to levy sanctions. As far as how it compares to other administrations, in several circles, I've heard President Obama referred to as the Great Deporter.
Yeah.
Given his numbers, what it turns on for me is how they carried them out.
Okay.
The rule of law, which is when you go to court, you don't win, you've had your due process, you fought your case, you've taken your appeal, whatever you've done, you've lost it. You can't say you didn't have your rights, and now it's over. Versus going into the Alien and Sedition Act of 1798, going into calling it a mass influx, an invasion at the southern border, calling them criminal aliens, having the DHS secretary going on TV and calling Venezuelan TPS recipients dirtbags or scumbags, or whatever the word she used. It's not the numbers themselves, which obviously were much higher during the eight Obama years, but it's what they're doing to carry out the removals and the rhetoric they're using for their fear-mongering campaign. That's way different from Obama and President Biden and even Trump 1.0. The fear was there, but a lot of that was quelled because of COVID. So one must think, if we didn't have the COVID pandemic, how would that have compared? And I think we would have seen a lot of what we're seeing now then, but COVID stopped that. So I think that also is causing a shock to us all, because he didn't have a chance to implement a lot of this, because he spent from the late part of 2019 all the way through the end of his presidency dealing with the pandemic and not having a full chance to flex. Also keep in mind, Thomas, that a lot of Trump's first policies in his first term were done without any thought whatsoever, which is obvious because how many of his policies were enjoined. Very few of his policies actually exist today from his first term, because he did it with no warning. He did it with no rationale, like his travel bans. And you're seeing a lot now of trying to, how many policy choices can we make that we can quickly carry out, and how many of them are we going to eventually have to fight in court? And what you're seeing now is the extension of executive power to its zenith to see how many people we can get rid of, deport, scare, before we actually have to use laws that we're probably going to have to defend in court. And that's not something we saw during Obama and or President Biden. And in Trump 1.0, he started with that. He started with, let's change the laws, let's change this, let's change that. And then they were all enjoined. So now they're going heavy on the executive, heavy on these deport, go back to your country campaigns, because if they can accomplish the same goal without having to litigate, all the better.
How might unions come to the defense of migrants, unions or other social institutions? And I say unions because, of course, migrants typically are workers that have changed countries and come to improve their lot in the United States. Because you used to hear that, you know, employees under these highly skilled labor categories, H-1B, these technical workers, are typically sponsored by a company. One is that, doesn't that typically tie them to that company for a length of time and thus help indenture those workers? And why can't unions do something like akin to sponsoring, you know, a whole group of workers, as, you know, these are our drywalleros. If you remember that strike back in some time ago, the construction workers in Southern California that struck a building trades employer. What do you think of that notion?
Yeah. So what I see a lot that I think unions can help out is, I'm going to call it ad hoc salary determinations. Today is Tuesday, I pay you X. Today is Wednesday, I'll pay you Y. Today is Thursday, I may not pay you at all, because they know the bargaining power. What are you going to, Thomas, what you really going to do? I'm paying you $2 an hour. You're going to run to immigration, especially now. You're going to run to immigration and say, Thomas is cheating me? No. They know that, but unions have the power to stop it. I mean, they could at least help alleviate the issues. That is the most common thing when I do consultations. I ask about employment and how they're treated and what they do. And the most common, now there are some close seconds and thirds, Thomas, but the most common is I'm taken advantage of in the area of salary, and it's always changing. It's, of course, never written down. That's why I call it ad hoc. So I think in these areas, you listed construction, agriculture, farming, other service jobs,
service
hotel
industries, you know, landscaping. Landscaping, McDonald's,
hotel cleaning crews, things like that. So I think that is in the previous administration, there were lots of avenues for non-citizens to work with the Labor Department to investigate these unscrupulous employers and could get some temporary immigration benefits for doing so. And again, to be in favor of that is just being human. If you're working, first of all, and let's also be clear about something, working without permission in the country is not a crime. It's not a crime. It's a crime for the employers, which is a different topic. But is it a, if you are working not with false papers, we're not talking about identity fraud here, Thomas. We're talking about Andres going to a construction job, getting a job and working there every day under his Mexican passport. Is that a crime? It is not. It is not. It is not an immigration offense crime where you can be prosecuted for working without permission. So it is a
civil. Will an employer open up a social security account for that employee? No.
No.
No, because so he won't withhold social security from his wages or match from his payroll costs, will he?
Right. Yeah. Because they're not eligible for. So what you do see a lot of the times, though, is they do withhold it. Because I see it. They do withhold it, but they can't access it because they can't get a Social Security card without at least a work permit under the Real ID Act, which is why we have all those gold stars on our license. So it's part of the same Real ID Act of 2005 that Bush 43 signed.
You're saying those employers withhold the money and keep it or actually turn it over to Social Security as sort of as a
general? No, they turn it over. Turn it over as part of FICA. Yeah, they turn it over as part of FICA. But I've seen it because I've looked at people's employment records. I've looked at it. I've seen the documents where they don't have any socials, yet FICA is taken out. And so they're paying into a system that they have no way of accessing.
Yeah.
You know, let that sit with you for a bit.
So that's a lie that they can illegally under the table collect these benefits.
There's no way to access them. Right. So yeah. They can get a tax ID number in order to file a tax return. But the way to tell the difference between a tax ID number and a Social Security card is a tax ID will always start with a 9 and a social will start with a 0 to an 8.
Yeah.
So people who don't know that are like, well, they have something that looks like a social. Actually, if it starts with a 9, it's just a tax ID number for purposes of filing federal and state income taxes for those states that have a state income tax. So what you see here is a situation where many employers that I've seen are taking advantage of workers. Not all of them. We're not over-categorizing, but I've seen this with alarming frequency when I do my own consults. And unions would be able to help in that area where we're going to be treating these workers fairly. And at the end of the day, the answer could be, if you have any questions about their immigration status, you're hiring them, you're bringing them on board. We're not talking about, for everyone out there, we're not talking about workers who swindle the employers by presenting fake documents and are thereby committing separate crimes. We're talking about the individuals who just go on their own name and are being taken advantage of. That's not right either. And unions could play a big role in minimizing salary abuse.
I think we're going to have to leave it there. Andrew Rankin, it's been an extreme pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you for sharing your knowledge with our Pacifica audience.
You're more than welcome, Thomas. It was a wonderful afternoon spending with you, and I wish you all the best. My website is www.ajrimmigration.com. I can be reached at ajrimmigration@outlook.com or at 901-238-6652.
That was immigration attorney Andrew Rankin of Memphis, Tennessee, speaking to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke in early March. On Friday, March 28th, Trump administration lawyers argued before the U.S. Supreme Court that they should be allowed to use the wartime authority granted under the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to deport migrants without due process, as, for example, when they are alleged to be members of Tren de Aragua, an allegedly Venezuelan-based criminal gang. Trump's lawyers were in part reacting to U.S. District Judge James Boasberg's ruling against this expanded interpretation of wartime as a basis for denial of due process. U.S. Department of Justice lawyers have recently turned to invoking state secrets as a rationale for withholding so-called sensitive information from the courts. We will continue to follow these unfolding stories. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Thomas O'Rourke and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.